Merry Christmas, and Happy Hanukkah, and Happy Kwanzaa. It is holiday week. I hope everyone in the Constant Listener Far Middle community is having the best of times, and I certainly wish you the best. I will start our holiday installment of the Far Middle, and officially it's episode 188 for those keeping score, with a sports dedication that is going to go down as one of the oldest that we've had, because the event we dedicate the episode to is now 110 years old. And it occurred at Christmas in 1914, during World War I, in the muddy, stinking, and freezing trenches of the Western Front. The Christmas Truce, as it was known, was a series of widespread, organic, unofficial ceasefires along the Western Front of the First World War, again, around Christmas 1914. And this was at the start of the war, only about 5 months after the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and the westward invasion by Germany into Belgium and France. The first battle of the Marne already occurred, and that halted the German advance, and things were at a stalemate, with trenches being built on both sides for the long haul and for the war of attrition that was to come. Lulls occurred in the fighting as armies exhausted themselves, both with respect to the physical human being exhaustion component, as well as with respect to things like ammunition. And commanders were resetting plans because the initial battle plans of both sides had been shattered. The week leading up to the Christmas season and Christmas Day saw French, German, and British soldiers. They began to cross the lines and trenches to exchange seasonal greetings and talk. And there wasn't a full degree of hate yet that had built up between the different sides. That would come later. And there were joint burial ceremonies and prisoner swaps, while several meetings ended in caroling and exchanging food. Specific to our sports dedication, there are many accounts of the truce involving soccer matches that were played in no man's land. Now, the truth of the accounts has been debated for years, but I think the evidence is compelling that such games indeed occurred. A German soldier, for example, said that the English brought a soccer ball from their trenches, and pretty soon a lively game ensued. How marvelously wonderful, yet how strange it was. That's from the diary or the account of a German soldier. Indeed, it looks like soccer was played that Christmas Day, both by men of the same nationality and also between troops from the opposing armies. The Christmas 1914 soccer matches between Germany and Britain, or Germany and France, along with the truce itself, was a one-and-done event, because the following year, ceasefires were not as widespread, and commanders on both sides forbade them, and animosity for the enemy, it by then grew in the trenches to hate levels. Soldiers were no longer in a truce mood after the meat grinder that was going to be 1915. But during Christmas in 1914, the human spirit displayed some of its best attributes in the form of soccer matches, while in the midst of the humans at their worst in the carnage of war. So episode 188, our Christmas episode, is dedicated to those World War I truce soccer matches 110 years ago. I thought that was a fitting sports dedication for this time of year in episode 188. Now, a question, and this episode's going to be discussing a couple of questions that I receive as inbounds, but one question people often ask about is whether I've got a database or some resource that I utilize to choose each week's sports dedication. And the short answer is that I do not. Instead, I rely on random and various readings and just perusing of everything from news sources to books to come up with what I hope would be intriguing dedication subjects. And I can tell you, quite amazingly, that after hundreds of these episodes and dedications, I still have a deep list of great dedication subjects to come. And hopefully that'll bring you months of future listening enjoyment on the Far Middle, at least at the start of each episode. Speaking of questions from constant listeners, I thought it would be a good time over Christmas week to address a couple of other questions that have popped up from constant listeners recently. And we can make our first connection, jumping from how I develop sports dedication topics and subjects to the question posed late this summer from a listener who hails from the great state of Michigan. And the question was whether I felt that the leftist movement in the United States, and to a wider extent globally for that matter, whether it's receding in impact and is experiencing pushback from various demographics and republics. That's a great question. And the blunt answer off the top is that, yes, I do think that the leftist movement and many of the things that it stands for is starting to suffer a crisis of support and pushback across many free societies. We see this dynamic globally when you look to places like Argentina. We see it supra-regionally in Europe. We see it in America across the federal, state, and local levels of government. And it doesn't mean that the left is vanquished or that it won't enjoy further imposition upon individuals and their freedoms for years to come. I wish that were the case. But it does mean that openly embracing foundational beliefs of the left is proving to be more and more of a liability when it comes to winning elections or continuing to hold on to elected office. And I came across an excellent article in late October by a journalist, Roy Teixeira, and he writes for the Free Press, and the title was How Progressives Blew It. I'll give that article a read. I think you will enjoy it. And the piece sums up how it wasn't that long ago that what he refers to as the progressive movement and what I call the leftist was riding high on a wave of enthusiasm and confidence when it came to the prospect of pushing its ideology through policies and politics across the nation and large swaths of the world. But since, many observers and many self-described progressives, they've come to realize the gross impracticality of the policies of the left. And when many of those policies have been pushed through society, you know, they end up making things much worse. The consequences of the policies, they're worse than the proffered problem that they were supposed to fix. So many politicians that are left-leaning, they've now tracked toward the middle and conveniently avoid discussion of their prior public support for such policies. Vice President Harris and her campaign for president was a perfect, and I think the biggest example of this tactic. And what she used to openly embrace as pillars of the left, she completely avoided or outright abandoned and reversed herself on when she ran for president. Much of this could be argued as in response to the Democratic Party realizing that the Republican Party led by Trump was eating into much of the traditional Democratic support base. Because the traditional Democrats, they didn't like what they were seeing or hearing when it came to the party embracing the hard left. Now, what would be the biggest policy areas or issues that have proven to be problematic when it comes to the left in places like America and Europe? The article laid out four that I agree with wholeheartedly. First was open borders, to where there was a massive influx of immigration without any sensible rule of law or process. It started when President Biden took office and imposed a slew of executive orders on immigration, but cumulatively over 4 years, it resulted in mathematical and societal disaster for cities and regions across this nation. And a similar, yet albeit further progressed situation with Europe has played out. So Europe's in some ways in even worse shape than what we experienced the past 4 years in the United States. And if you don't have a secure border, most people, they understood that you can't have a secure nation. And that doesn't make you a monster to think so. It just makes you logical and rational. President Trump, in his 2024 campaign, seized upon this to great benefit. And that's how the once border czar suddenly absolved herself of any knowledge of what was going on with the border and any responsibility for it. And there was a June CBS survey, a CBS News survey, that found 62% of voters supported starting a new national program to deport all undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States illegally. Supporters included 53% of Hispanics and almost 60% of white college graduates. I thought that survey results by CBS News was very interesting and telling back earlier this year. The second giant fail of the left was sort of tied to open borders, but it was much wider in scope, at least from my perspective. And that is not enforcing rule of law and tolerating the breakdown of society that comes with it. It started with a desire by many in America to pursue sensible police and criminal justice reform after the killing of George Floyd. But the left turned it into a defund the police and an opportunity to jettison public safety. And those are not avenues for criminal justice reform. Those are avenues toward anarchy. Now, much of this was initiated and weaponized with the progressive prosecutor movement that we discussed earlier on the Far Middle this year. When prosecutors refused to enforce the law and didn't prosecute obvious crimes, it wasn't shocking that spikes in violent crimes gripped the nation. and most Americans equated it as a symptom of the lax on crime policy of the left. This played out in tragic form in large American cities like San Francisco and Philadelphia, and it's a theme that I wrote about extensively in my book Precipice, and one that we discussed extensively on the podcast. This failure probably was the single biggest contributor to eroding away supporters from the Democratic Party to the President Trump-controlled Republican Party, because the middle class and the working poor who lived in and around large American cities were the ones that suffered the negative consequences when the rule of law was eradicated by policy. The affluent suburbanite didn't see much of a change at all in their safety, especially with white-collar workers working remotely from home in sort of their safer cocoons. But those that lived in the cities and that had to travel the subways to get to not just one, but in many instances, two or three jobs, you know, those that were grinding every day to make ends meet, they experienced and suffered firsthand the consequences of lax law enforcement, and they didn't like it. A Pew poll found that Black and Hispanic Democrats, many who live in cities and are in our middle class and working class, they were significantly more likely than white Democrats, who often reside in suburbs and are more affluent, to favor more police funding in their communities. And that, to me, makes perfect sense. In the end, despite at times serious imperfections, and I mean serious imperfections, and the need for constant improvements, policing does work. The third factor that's creating serious headwinds for the left, I think it's the toughest of the four to categorize or label. In the article, the journalist labeled it as identity politics, but I'm not sure that's a good descriptor. I view it as more of an obsession of always demonizing the idea of America and vilifying the individual as inherently biased. It's, let's say, a very negative attitude on America and on Americans. Every decision, every historical event, every policy has to have some negative connotation or grievance tied to it. And it's a weird dynamic whereby the left obsesses on this and it injects it into every imaginable position, but yet it ends up having little material impact in the real world. And it manages to tick off just about every individual American and demographic that you can think of. And this dynamic, I think, often appears in areas where it comes across to me as anti-Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King Jr. said that people should not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, right? We've all know that. We've all heard that. And most Americans would agree with Dr. King. I would hope that, like, the vast majority of Americans would agree, along with people deserving an equal opportunity to succeed, no matter what their race, color, creed, or ethnicity might be. Everybody gets that and supports that. But when the left starts to vilify America and Americans and starts talking in techno-speak, it turns most Americans off. And when they get turned off, Americans start to pay attention to and support whoever is not embracing that message. And in this case, it is often the opposing party. The final pillar, foundationally, of the left that's causing pushback from America and the West is one that I'm very familiar with and the constant listeners of this podcast are well aware of. The climate change is an existential threat and that energy abundance is an evil that has to be surrendered. It's a far cry from the good old days of all of the above when it comes to energy policy that the Democratic Party had embraced not that long ago. We're now told that the world will end without drastic action, but not to worry because you can drop fossil fuels and replace them with renewables and life will become much more enjoyable. The climate's going to improve and everything will be more affordable. But then physics and chemistry, you know, they reared their heads as they always do and they blew up that fantasy. Renewables, wind and solar, they can't deliver on cost, on scale, or on dependability. Climate policies have become a massively regressive tax on middle-class working Americans to basically subsidize multi-billion-dollar global corporations with no benefit to climate. You question the religion of climate alarmism and you get attacked by the whole of government and you get labeled as a denier of a religion. Now, this was from President Biden in 2023, last year. The only existential threat humanity faces, even more frightening than a nuclear war, is global warming going above 1.5 degrees in the next 20 to 10 years. That's the real trouble. There's no way back from that. That's straight from President Biden's mouth. Yet in the 2024 presidential race, Vice President Harris hardly uttered a word on climate change. And that was probably a smart move, despite the outcome. And most Americans don't want any of what the religion of climate alarmism is peddling. People generally like an all-of-the-above approach to energy policy, and they insist upon reliable and affordable energy. In a recent survey, only 26% of Americans back a rapid renewables transition, only 26%. And that's with all the lies and mythology being told that's been created about renewables. If people knew the scientific reality, the support would be even lower. NBC conducted a poll to test a range of policy proposals to see what voters would support when it came to a candidate who espoused them. And the single most positive response among voters was a proposal to expand domestic oil and natural gas production. And that's again why you saw Vice President Harris flip on her fracking position during the presidential campaign. Indeed, the left is facing pushback from America on several policy and ideology pillar fronts, and that is awesome news. Now, another question I received from a constant listener makes a connection to our next dot, which is electric vehicles. The question from a friend of the far middle in Ohio asks, Nick, you've been a longtime critic of electric vehicle mandates and policies. Can you point to specific examples or data that would back your position on EVs now that these types of policies have been in place for years in Europe and in places like California? That is another great question, and I can answer in the affirmative. Indeed, I can. I will select two iconic car makers, one from Europe and one from America, to highlight with recent data how much of the debacle electric vehicle mandates have become for both consumers and manufacturers. So let's start across the pond in Europe with Volkswagen. The end of October, Volkswagen announced it could close three vehicle factories, cut 10,000 jobs, and impose across-the-board pay reductions to its employee base. Now, that news shocked Germany, but it should not have come as a surprise if you follow the math of electric vehicle mandates and their devastating impact on automakers. Now, keep in mind the reason why it shocked Germany. Volkswagen has avoided involuntary layoffs for three decades, and it hasn't closed a factory in Germany in its 87-year history. That's amazing. And unfortunately, that looks to no longer be the case. And many in the media and in the expert class, they blame the consequences of Volkswagen's Dieselgate scandal when the company was installing software in its cars to get around emissions tests. You remember that with Dieselgate? They blame all this on sort of the hangover effect from Dieselgate. And by the way, Dieselgate, interestingly, was outed by about people or researchers that sit roughly 45 minutes from where I am in Morgantown, West Virginia at WVU. It was WVU researchers that broke the scandal of Dieselgate. But these problems at Volkswagen, they are not from Dieselgate. They are from electric vehicle policies coupled with high energy costs that strangle manufacturing efficiencies and that are also induced by climate policies, just like the EV mandates. It's as if climate policies are squeezing Volkswagen from both ends. Higher energy prices drive up its costs, and the EV mandates strangle its sales. That's a bad combination. Now, as to those EV mandates, the EU requires that the internal combustion engine be phased out by 2035. So now Volkswagen has to cut costs drastically, and that's going to cause pain across a spectrum of its stakeholders. And as to Volkswagen's costs, its German plants are twice as expensive as its competitors. Not exactly Fahrvergnügen, which, if you remember, was the Volkswagen slogan not long ago that translates to driving pleasure. But we shouldn't gloat in the United States because jumping back to the States doesn't show much better results when it comes to automakers' misery tied to EV mandates. Consider the most iconic of automakers, Ford, and its recent news at the start of November. Ford's going to idle production of its F-150 Lightning electric truck in Michigan for the rest of the year. And that follows a string of bad news when it comes to EV manufacturing for Ford. Toward the end of 2023, it announced plans to lay off hundreds of workers who built the Lightning. In the spring of this year, Ford said it would eliminate two of the three work crews at its Michigan plant that manufactures the EV truck. And in August of this year, Ford killed its plans for an electric SUV. Ford sold less than 23,000 Lightnings through the third quarter of 2024, while the Michigan factory was supposed to produce 180,000 of those vehicles. That explains the layoffs and the scale down. The CFO of Ford lamented the trucks don't work well when operating as EVs because the batteries need to be bigger. That makes the vehicle less efficient and heavier and more expensive. And Ford's EV division lost over $3.5 billion during the first three quarters of this year. It works out to about $55,000 per electric vehicle and expects total 2024 losses to be around $5 billion. So whether it is iconic Volkswagen or iconic Ford, whether it's in Germany or the United States, EV mandates and the broader climate policies driven by the ideology of the left, they're paving a path of destruction far, wide, and deep. Let's wrap up our Yuletide episode of The Far Middle and our focus this week on some interesting Q&A. I'll make a final connection to the last dot for this week, which is a final question. This came from an acquaintance of mine that I run into from time to time on the weekends, a fellow Catholic who noted a few months back that I've been a constant, albeit measured, critic of the current leadership of the Catholic Church at the Vatican, particularly Pope Francis. And the question was, do I have any individuals or areas of the Catholic Church leadership that I see as inspirational today? Now, some of you may remember a few weeks back that we talked about Pope John Paul II as a shining light. And I think I've got another positive example through the Catholic Church at work today. And it's an individual who went by the name of Father Edward J. Flanagan. He was a priest during the first half of the 20th century up to the end of the 1940s. And he's currently being considered for sainthood by the Vatican. And to become a saint, there's rules. The individual would need to have confirmed two miracles. Now, I won't get into the specifics, but Father Flanagan has 20 such incidents to his credit. There's a documentary about him if you want to learn more. It's titled The Heart of a Servant, the Father Flanagan Story. Now, Father Flanagan, born in Ireland, made his way to Nebraska, where he founded what became known as Boys Town outside of Omaha. And the mission of Boys Town was to educate homeless and destitute youth. The thousands of kids who grew up through Boys Town viewed Flanagan as a father figure, both in spirit as well as in life. He actually became known as America's number one war dad during the Second World War because so many of the Boys Town alumni listed him as next of kin when they enlisted into the armed forces to fight the Axis. Flanagan took in kids of all races, all religions, and he succeeded in creating a community of family among them. He received death threats from the Ku Klux Klan. He flew in the face of Jim Crow laws at a time when no one dared to do so. And get this, Omaha didn't allow white and black children to be housed under the same roof. So Father Flanagan, he moves his operation outside of Omaha in the middle of a cornfield, and he created his own town that became known as Boys Town, Nebraska. And it actually ended up having its own post office that opened in 1934. Boys Town was the first of its kind in America. And remember, this was during the Depression, when the need for such an institution was exponentially great. And he was called upon by General Douglas MacArthur at the end of World War II to help rebuild the crushed societies in Japan and Korea, which were filled with orphans. And he was then asked to help with the rebuilding of Europe. In fact, he died of a heart attack in Berlin in 1948 when he was doing his work. And he's buried, as you might expect, at the chapel in Boys Town, Nebraska. And if you don't like documentaries, you can still learn about Father Flanagan from a famous Hollywood film back in the day. Flanagan would use radio to tell the stories of some of the kids at Boys Town using actors. And he would have a short personal address at the end of each show after the actors performed their pieces. That radio show became very popular, caught the attention of the newspaper tycoon William Randolph Hearst, which created more popularity for Flanagan in Boys Town. And in 1938, Hollywood made a movie about him titled Boys Town. And Spencer Tracy, he played the lead role of Father Flanagan. Mickey Rooney, by the way, was also in that film. And wouldn't you know it, Spencer Tracy won the Oscar for his performance of Father Flanagan in Boys Town. Here's what Spencer Tracy inscribed on a special Oscar statuette that he gave to Father Flanagan. To Father Flanagan, whose great humanity, kindly simplicity, and inspiring courage were strong enough to shine through my humble effort, Spencer Tracy. Now, when you wrap up an episode during Christmas week about a priest who inspired and raised thousands of orphans during the Depression, who helped rebuild Asia and Europe after the devastation of a world war, who became a celebrity through radio and newspapers, and then who helped an iconic actor win an Academy Award, you know that you've hit far middle nirvana. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah. Until next week, always stay connected to that far middle.